I'm going to talk about the symbology of the tarot cards. Say tarot, some say tarot. Those who say tarot don't think you can read it both ways. Those who say tarot think that you can. A third man has not yet decided whether either or both are right or wrong, because the whole pack is very, very mysterious. Some think it appeared about the 13th century, some about the 18th century. Some it is a dreadful forgery, a mishmash of symbologies from all different systems of thought. But the gypsies are credited with having brought it all the way from Egypt, although they personally never came from Egypt, but from India. And the symbolism is stated in occult circles to be derived from the book of Thoth, lovely word, T-H-O-T-H, translate Thoth. What does it sound like? I don't like saying Thoth myself. I prefer to say Tahot. Because that's very difficult and cumbersome, I'll say Thoth. I'll only say it once more, and then I won't refer to it again, because it doesn't necessarily correspond with the fact anyway. Because the only information we have about Thoth, that's the last time I'm going to say it, is that he is the Egyptian equivalent of the Christian Logos, the Greek Hermes, the Roman Mercury, and is the articulate word of the absolute. Starting from which, we will examine this card. The most obvious thing about this card is that it is entitled The Magician. Now, it corresponds with the letter A, which, as you know, is the free vowel, the kind of noise babies make when they're first born. It is a sound that can be made by inarticulate people quite well, and therefore it must be very basic. When we think of this card, we are to contemplate that we have here, in the representation of a human being, the magical force of the universe, prior to any encapsulation. Now, we are to think about this in a very special way. All those of you who have studied the last 2,500 years of European philosophy will have assimilated the idea that there are such things as abstract ideas, and often abstract ideas get into disrepute by gross materialists who think that anything that is abstract is necessarily unreal. But that may not be so, because the ideas that are called abstract, that is, general concepts like table, chair, horse, and so on, as opposed to particular things like that particular horse, that particular table, these concepts can be viewed in two totally different ways. But one thing is certain about them is that however you view them, they exist in the human consciousness. So-called abstract ideas are concrete facts formed in the human consciousness. So we are going to attack very vigorously anybody who believes that an idea, because it is called abstract, is thereby somehow weakened. And we're going to show to the contrary that ideas have been the major determinants of human evolution and have shown themselves to possess more energy than the emotional world, because without ideas we couldn't have civilization and we would wallow in an emotional state. And they have more power than matter, because by manipulation of ideas the material world has been conquered. It is by the manipulation of general ideas, so-called abstract, that we have put men on the moon. So we are going to use a very special term to symbolize this first card. We are going to talk about the concrete absolute. We are doing this deliberately because the word absolute is in disrepute by all materialists. Materialists refer to the absolute as if it corresponded with nothing whatever, because the absolute, by definition, cannot be put on the laboratory table, cannot be cut into pieces, cannot be taken apart like matter can. The absolute means absolute. That is, when you take away, conceptually, in your mind only, all the finites, all the limitation factors, all the temporal factors, all changing factors, what remains in consciousness is the absolute, the away solved. But this absolute is very peculiar, because when we, in abstract thought, that is taking ideas away from other ideas, when we draw away, abstract one idea from another, we are doing this in our mind by a special kind of operation. We are not having any effect whatever on the concrete reality, total reality. And this total reality we are going to call the concrete absolute. I'm going to examine the word concrete, because the word concrete is quite wrong. But it is the only word that we can use at this stage to express this idea. Concrete means grown together. So if you make a concrete path, you get some cement and sand and aggregate, and you mix it all together. And through the action of this cement, it appears to grow together, to cohere, and become the paving stone on which you walk. Concrete means grown together. But this absolute has not grown together in the sense that it was once, like cement and sand and various sizes of stones, aggregate that you mix with the sand and the cement. This absolute has never been, at any time or prior to time, has never been in bits, has never been in parts, has never been atomistic, has never been particularized. This absolute is a holistic continuum. It is seamless. It corresponds with the seamless garment of Christ when you think about the absolute as that which is worn by the infinite consciousness as its first garment. It is seamless because it is not made of parts. And you remember in the story of Christ that the seamless garment had to be gambled for. The soldiers cast lots for it because they couldn't take it to pieces like they would have taken to pieces a jacket with sleeves and body and pockets and so on. Taking a piece of cloth each, because it was seamless, they had to gamble for it. And that is a tremendously important point, because this particular magician is wearing a seamless garment, in this case colored red, to symbolize energy. Because fundamentally, all the manifest world is a function of energy. But this energy is seamless. It is not made apart. It is not made of separated atoms existing in voidity. So when we look at this magician, we have to think that it symbolizes the concrete absolute. The absolute that is not an abstract idea in the way the materialists use that term. It is the absolute as total seamless reality. Now it is called the magician here. In some texts it's called the juggler. It could be called anything that means he who manipulates all phenomena. So that when we come to think about anything whatever that exists in the actual world, by saying actual world, we are talking about actuality, and that means action. And this concrete absolute, and we're using the word concrete to remind you to hold it together, although in fact it has never been separated into parts. It is seamless, and it, at the level of its manifestation, actualization, is energy. Above that level, it is pure consciousness. Because it is infinitely extended, filling all space absolutely, it is also called infinite substance. So we have a substance, and we have consciousness. And the state of this consciousness is a state of unimpeded motion. And this unimpeded motion is called ananda, that is, bliss. It is the motion of a serpent with no obstacles swimming about in the infinite. It is an undulating wave of sentient power. In yoga it is called sat-chit-ananda, that is, being, consciousness, bliss. In Christianity you call it Father, Son and Holy Ghost. In some other systems, like the Egyptian system, you'd call it father, mother, son. When you call it father, you mean power. When you call it mother, you mean the substantial aspect of the same power as space filler. And when you call it son, you mean the apple of the mother-father's eye as the intelligence, the creative intelligence that results from the interaction of power with itself in its substantial activity. Power fills all space. As space filler, we call it substance. As initiator of the process, we will refer to it as power, and this is the same word as father, pater, pitr, and so on. All mean to initiate. It is pure initiative, and because it fills all space, the same power is substance. There are not two things here, power and substance. There is only one. A power that filling all space is called substance when it behaves in a certain way. To change that P into M, as in pom, like an apple, you have to change it by closing the mouth and humming in the mouth with the lips closed. P is a plosive and implies a precipitation. M is a continuous sound, a humming sound, and it is this humming sound that is made by the closure of power on itself, that turns P into M and Pa into Ma and Da into Ma in Ad into Am in Adam. Adam is only a particularized symbol at the earth level of the same polarized Pa. Pa as infinite occupied of space is substance, glyph M. Pa as Pa, initiative, that is the same. So there is no question here of any conflict whatever between the P and the M, or if you were to change the P into an S sound to symbolize significance, we could then use the Hebrew letters Shin and Mem. Now Shin in Hebrew means fire, and Mem means water. And Shamayim means heaven, because it's made of two aspects, energy aspect called fire, substantial aspect called water. There is no dualism. This is tremendously important because everything inside the universe is nothing but this same power. This means that every human individual is a power and a substance. But the power and the substance are not in any way separated from each other. So that when you become aware that you are a power, then you are in a position to precipitate the forms of substance that you will to precipitate. Whereas if you think, that is, formulate a concept that is erroneous, namely the concept that your power, your will, is distinct from, alien to, your substance, you then generate with this erroneous idea a concept that you cannot act upon your substance because it is other than your power. If we said that P for power is utterly alien to M, then there is no interfunction between them possible. It is not possible for utterly alien things to interact. So if you believe that the substance of your body is in any way dualistically separated from your will, then this erroneous idea will determine a difficulty, namely, how can you operate on the substance of your body with a will that is in no sense able to interfere with substance. So materialists cannot believe that will is a real term. They say will is a fiction. There is nothing except the behavior of bodies. We call them mechanistic behaviors. Luckily, they're in fair disrepute at the moment because they're rather naive in their formulation. But it is still there by inertia for people in general to believe that the substance of their bodies is distinct from the power of their will, and therefore they have no power over their bodies. And the body somehow mysteriously functions and conditions them by its physical inertias, by its impulses, its conations, by its affections, its emotions, and by its peculiar mechanical cognitions in the brain cells. it is precisely this that this card of the magician is designed to smash. The first letter, A, precedes the second letter, B, and the letter B symbolizes to encapsulate. But when we think about encapsulation, we're always left with, beyond this sphere of encapsulation, an infinity of the same power that produced the encapsulation. So here we have, prior to any encapsulation, an absolute, holistic, seamless, concrete power. And by concrete, we do not mean built out of separate elements. We mean that it concretes its own functions. That is, the seamless power functions in a variety of ways and then puts these ways together, functional ways, not separate atomistic ways, functional ways. It integrates its functions. And therefore, we can say it is functionally a concrete absolute without impairing its holistic continuum nature. Now we observe above the head of this magician a figure of eight lying on its side. Now this symbolizes infinity in math, and in occult philosophy it signifies reciprocity. Imagine two circles. They are both encapsulated zones of function. They are not encapsulated zones of discrete material particles, because those don't exist. They are encapsulated zones of function. So if I go like this with my hand and make a circle, and if I were to do a contrary motion with my left hand, so that the two hands met in the middle, I would make two circles, and you could say that is a figure of eight. But really, there is nothing there except function. No separate spheres of action. And one of these functions feeds into the other function. So then is reciprocity. It is the very type of polarized relation such as you find on Earth in a sexual relation, where the two circles symbolize two functions of force. The only difference between a male and a female is functional. They have the same protoplasmic origin, same number of chromosomes in the nucleus, same general pattern of nervous distribution, and so on. But they have different functions. So when we look at this circle, or in this case ellipse, a flattened circle, towards his right hand, we have to say that symbolizes the male function. When we look at the one towards his left hand, that symbolizes the female function. So if I make a gesture over there, that symbolizes male function. And if I go over here, it symbolizes female function. Now, if I make this gesture clockwise, that's the way the sun goes around the sky every day, clockwise, traveling from the east, we're in the northern hemisphere, from the east to the west via the south, then if I do this, I can say this is the right way to go round, like the fingers on the clock. We can say that is diocele, the way God goes, to the right, the way the sun god goes. If I go around this way, then I'm saying widdershins, that means anti-illumination. That means against the sun. In witchcraft, widdershins means walk anti-clockwise. Now, if I say I'm going to turn right, correct way for a man, he's a righteous being, he's an ethical being, he's a rational being, and that's right. Who says so? The man. Is a self-defining system. What I do is right, and I think, and I reason, and I invented the term right. So therefore, this is right. Consequently, when I come to reciprocate with the other being, this is wrong. This is medicine. This is irrational. This is feminine. Now we have to consider this very carefully, because this figure of eight is the key to the whole figure. With his right hand, he is pointing upwards, and he is pointing up to power. With his left hand, he is pointing down to the earth. So his right hand is symbolizing the turning the right way, clockwise, and with his left hand, turning the wrong way, anti-clockwise, with his shins. Now, those who turn the right way derive from patriarchal cultures, where men ruled and constructed a rational system, and they made long, long ago marvelous solar monuments. And we refer to these people as heliolithic-centered people, sandstone, heliolithic, sandstone cultures. Stonehenge is an obvious example, the second pyramid in Egypt, the Aztec pyramids in Mexico and so on. All these are examples of sand cultures with patriarchal rulers. But the Widdershins ones are matriarchal and moon-determined. The men worship the sun, the women worship the moon. The obvious relation between moon and menstruation in the case of woman needs little comment. It shows that they are periodic and earthbound in a way that the male function is not. And remember, we cannot separate male and female into two distinct beings. We can only say there is a functional bias in the so-called male towards rationality and initiative, and a functional bias in the so-called female towards appealing approach and earth orientation. And this is what we have to read into this simple figure of eight turned horizontally. You will also see in the card some lilies and roses. And both of these flowers are sacred to the Virgin Mary, and the sacredness of these flowers and their relation with the Virgin Mary is found in pre-Christian times to be sacred to the goddess Venus, Ashtaroth, Astarte, Isis, and so on. Now, the word rose means to develop. To develop oneself in any way is to exhibit rose function, because this R means to differentiate, and this S means to issue. So the issue of a differentiation of consciousness is a development. So this word rose means to develop, and it is therefore male. So very peculiarly, the rose belongs to the male side of the human being, and the lily to the female side. Now, the lily has a very, very complex symbology based on a fundamental simplicity that to disport, that is to play, because this word lily means play, and the Hebrew lila, and the Hebrew word for night, which is leila laila, like lilo, means to play about and to conjoin and to cling and so on. So the L function in lily, which is duplicated, is the exact opposite significance to the R function in rose. When you say an R like a true Scot, then you trill it, and in trilling it, you differentiate. And that means to clarify by differentiation. But when you hold everything together and stop it differentiating and cling to it and don't let it differentiate, like a very affectionate wife doesn't let her husband differentiate if she can stop it, when you do this, then you are a true lily. Now, it's perfectly obvious here that the symbolism of L and R has the same relation to this reciprocal figure of eight that the right hand pointing up and the left hand pointing down have in this magician. Because we can develop in two ways. We can develop the rose technique. Ruach is Hebrew for spirit and symbolizes the high intellect, not the empirical intellect of the material man, but the intuitively enlightened intellect. So that rose there has the same developmental significance that the Hebrew Ruach does, and this is the same thing that's symbolized in Sinbad the Sailor, the bird called the rock, the R-O-C, and the rook in a game of chess. They all symbolize differentiating power, whereby any person can discover his own potential, discover the hidden powers in his own substance, and by his own power, which is his own substance, he can arise, he can arrow himself, he can plow into his own being and produce out of himself all the necessary differentiations. But it is also possible to learn by lilying about the place, that is by playing. And one of the chief things that was learned in the ancient world, in the sport called Lulu, whom you will remember you never need to bring to a party because she comes on her own. The first thing that the human race learned from Lulu was Vidi. Now, this is a very interesting thing, that particular disorder, you know, cannot be got except from somebody who's got it. So the problem is raised, how did the first human being get it when you can't get it from a human being unless they've got it? Obviously, the human being got it from somewhere else. And there were certain suspects in the ancient world, and euphemistically, they said the culprit of all this is the lily. Because lilies grow in rank, foul places. And especially among the rank and file of the army. There is something about the lily and the pollen of the lily in certain types of water that makes it quite possible that you could contract very peculiar disorders by making an embrocation of lily pollen. And this is the way the priests of the ancient world accounted for the appearance of this disease. Anyhow, in the name of this disease, if you care to read in your Old Testament, you will find that priests examine all kinds of sores in people and said, oh, well, that's one of those, so you must go away now because you're not fit to mix with us. That person was cast out because he'd been consorting with something like a lily outside the human gametic theory. But a most strange thing occurred from this most noxious disorder. Because of this disease, and this is quite peculiar to say, because of this disease, human beings, who were then only potentially aware of themselves, were driven into separation from the animal world. It became an absolute rule, thou shalt not cohabit except with human beings. And so one of the worst things in the world turned out to be one of the best things in the world. According to Jacob Burma's famous rule, the worst is as good as the best. Because of this dread disorder, human beings were made terribly aware of the kind of things they were doing with the highest energy that they have. Because the peculiar thing about sexual energies in the body is that they are the most refined of all the energies that you derive from your food. Just think about it, that those sexual energies are so powerful that they produce more human beings able to think and feel and will, coordinate, embody their projects, all out of some essence you derive from your food. Because if you starve yourself totally, your performance disappears. But this particular energy was being misused. It was there for evolution, and it was being used for devolution. And this particular disease made it quite clear that the center of power corresponding with God the Father, the very power aspect of the universe, was being wrongly directed backwards into the animal world, a devolution, instead of into the human developmental world. So the lily symbolized lesson number one. You can learn by playing about. Some people call it the long way of learning. It's possible to learn from a pamphlet from Her Majesty's Stationery Offices certain statistics. With the aid of those, if you're a rose type being, that is, if you can differentiate in your intellect, you might actually be able to say to yourself, that means that if I go in a pub, I'm a 1 in 10 chance of coming out with something I didn't take in. But if you can do that kind of thought and then obey your thought, you're a rose being. But if you can't do that kind of thing, you're only a lily being. So the lily and the rose are there, or were there until they vanished, in order to state there are two ways of learning, a quick way, which is terribly hard, namely hard, clear logic, and a slow way, which is terribly easy. So you have to decide whether you do it the hard way, quickly, or the easy way over a long time. Now also, he has a table. And on that table, there are four symbols. One of them is called a pentacle, another is a chalice, another is a staff or club, and another is a sword. Now this symbolizes that there are four processes which are basic to this concrete absolute power. And one of them, the club, symbolizes sheer bashing force, what the psychologists call conation, the kind of Freudian id forces. They just hammer when they want something. They use the club. They're very basic and rudimentary, but not terribly clever. Another one is the pentacle. That's a little circle. That means money, coinage. Count it. Five-pointed star means use your five senses in every material situation and count up every event. Because if you count up accurately, remember when you're counting, you're being a rose-type being, you are differentiating yourself intellectually. When you count accurately, you may find a better method of dealing with something than using a club. If you are a watch repairer, for instance, then you don't have on your wall a nice piece of wood with thick outjuttings and large bases for clubs. When somebody brings you a watch, you don't say, yes, what's the money with this? Hasn't gone since Tuesday. Never, I'll serve 5 guineas. It isn't done that way. A good watchmaker actually knows that there are little wheels in your watch. And he knows there are little screws, because when you get your watch back, he's always taken 4 or 5 out and kept those in case he needs them for another watch. Now that's called good pentacle work. Now there are 2 other things. There is a sword, and this sword is very, very subtle in its symbology. It means power to inflict death. This is the sword carried by justice. But it also means another thing. It means the word. Sword is S word, where S equals spirit, equals significance. You can kill people with words far more efficiently and with less probability of being noticed killing them if you kill them with words. I mean, if you go about with swords killing people, the other people who are not yet dead, because you haven't got around to them yet, tend to become alarmed and to take defensive or evasive action. Whereas, if you kill them with words, that is, you write a novel, like Henry Miller or something, with the aid of this, you can actually kill, in the mind, the very functional possibility that constitutes humanity. It is possible, with rotten books, to destroy developmental possibilities in the human race. And we know, from the way that great religious works have been treated in the past, that the enemies of truth have actually burned books which they thought contained truths. There have been some very, very big burnings. Great burning of libraries in China, great burning in Egypt, great burning in Germany a few years ago. Even in America, the burning of the works of Wilhelm Reich. And there weren't many of them, but still they had to be destroyed, because it was believed they contained a dangerous truth. So this leads us with the chalice. Now the chalice is a very, very subtle symbol, because in this chalice is presumed to be the wine of life, that is, spirit itself. And the chalice symbolizes pure whiteness. This is the cow in calc, in calcium, in chalk cliffs of Dover and such like things. Cow means stone, white, pure. Calculate, the calculus, a little stone. But somehow it's been carved into the shape of a chalice. That is, this hard stone, the least recipient of all substances that we know of, has been cut by cunning, by pentacular work, and by club work to support it, and by definitions of that sort. This hard, resistant material, this stone, has been made into the perfect recipient of spirit. Now, the chalice has always been a symbol of pure femaleness. Pure femaleness means femaleness unadulterated by thought, no masculine element whatever, and the essence of pure femaleness is receptive power, the capacity to receive and to hold value. If you teach a woman to think, and you actually succeed in this, you will be conditioning her mode of reception of things in some degree. And you may find, if you're not careful with your educational procedures, that she is no longer able to assimilate the purity of the absolute concrete, the concrete absolute, because of the ideas that have been imposed upon her recipient substance. So the chalice, as we see in the Eucharist, is terribly important. It means the Virgin Mary. Virgin Mary means Virgin, male, female, and Mary means the principle of substance and differentiation. Ma means substantial principle, good Tibetan for mother, good Lancashire for mother for that matter, maybe the Tibetans came from Lancashire. Ma-ri means substantial activity as a whole, and the ri means to laugh, to differentiate, to see the possibilities that arise out of being a pure substance. So this Virgin Mary means man, woman, substance, continuum, differentiated, happy. And it refers to the infinite continuum of the power, which is also the substance of reality, prior to creation. She is spotless, immaculate, unspotted, prior to creation. The moment of creation is the moment of the appearance of encapsulation equals the first spot. But prior to creation, she is the Immaculate, the Virgin Mary. And this means that your own substance of your own being can be discovered by your own self-examination to be identical with this fundamentally, because all your impurities are nothing but erroneous rationalizing. To be impure is the same thing as to be irrational. I'm not talking now about empirical reason, I'm talking about pure logos, universal cosmic reason. That universal cosmic reason makes the perfect form in your substance, and it is there, and you cannot get rid of it, whatever you do. It is always there underneath, deeper than the Freudian id, deeper than all crude forces. It's the purity of your unspotted substance. And any spots that you may have are on the surface, and they are the product of erroneous ideas, erroneous rationalizings of existence. So this magician, apparently gets cooled off every now and then. This magician must be thought of as the state or non-state, prior to all states, prior to creation, of infinite power, a functional concrete or concrete functional absolute, not made of parts, pure power, and there is no other substance other than its very power itself. Above at the top, of course, you have some hanging things that, if they had been drawn properly, might have looked like grapes, and they symbolize, of course, the spirit itself incarnate. The grape is the type. Those of you who use that famous lady impressor called the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, who know that the grape is that which does with logic absolute the 270 darling sects compute. That is to say that the spirit can destroy all erroneous ideas, all spurious reasons, hence at the top of this card. And this means this card is very, very rich. It is not just a card for a game. It is a highly condensed symbology of the pre-creational possibilities. Actually, I shouldn't go on to any of the other cards. I should keep talking about this card, but then if I talk about this card, somebody will say to me afterwards, I thought you were going to talk about the Tarot cards, plural. So we leave this magician and we'll go on to the next card. And we observe this card is called the High Priestess. Now it's called the High Priestess not to represent anything whatever on earth. Earth does not yet exist. This High Priestess is the first ensphering of the power symbolized by the magician. The magician ensphere and produces a substance for himself, and this substance is himself in his role as recipient of his own initiative. When you do something, your substance records what you do. When you think, your protoplasm records what you think, and you will have to pay the price of what you think. As a man thinks in his heart, so is he. That means in the heart, in the feeling, in the center of your being. Where you think, and where you're very glad that you're thinking that thought, and where you think that thought is very valuable and you like it, then the emotive charge on this thinking changes your chemistry so that you actually become chemically prone to rethink this same thought in the same way. You become such a being that generated such a thought, and you are now chemically suffering from the inertia of this process. So we have to think that your substance itself is a precipitate of your own initiative, your own thought, your own decision to create, your own agreement with this idea and that idea. Many people get away with things for years and years and distress other people who say there can't be any God in the world because that man is a double-dyed rogue and he's getting away with it. What they're not seeing is the coronary in him at 40, 45. What they're not seeing is a highly complex series of stress strains in him that will somehow murder him because of his own internal inconsistencies which he can't see. What they're not seeing is that if he does this, he will transmit also to his children, to the third and fourth generation, the same tendencies to carry on in the same way. We are all inheritors of thousands of generations of people with erroneous ideas who have tried to make us be what they wish to be. And when we revolt, they refer to us as ungrateful children. Here we find the High Priestess, and she is the letter B. Not yet gross material particles. Those come much later. She represents the first ensphering, and her substance inside this sphere represents the Mary, the cosmic Mary, as opposed to the infinite. Now this Mary has inside her logic, the Logos, which is her son. And this son is the truth which appears in the functioning of this closed sphere of substance. Now historically, it is interesting that the cause of this fact of the substantial origin and the equation of substance with femaleness, that the substance was worshipped. Remember, worship means worth shape. It is worth shaping a substance because the shaped substance is a function embodied. Right at the beginning, we find at the head of creation, what is set up on the cosmic throne is the figure of a female. But behind this female is the male, God the Father, the Absolute, who generated this woman figure as his own spouse. She is the cosmic Eve, as he is the cosmic Adam. And she is an encapsulated and ensphered being designed by the Absolute for the Absolute to enter into and impregnate and produce a universe inside her of manifest forms. So she has a very high significance. She represents cosmic as opposed to infinite, cosmic substance with wisdom inside her and polarity. You observe on the one side a black column, on the other side a white column. On the black one you have a B, which is Boaz, and on the one on the left side you have the J, Yachin. One signifies strength, the other to establish. Both together, stability. But the Boaz one means that when you have a sphere, the sphere itself is buzzing with strength. The power that has made this sphere is buzzing inside it, and it desires to carry on with creation. So there's a tremendous urge in the female, the black side of the female, tremendous potential, dark coronation. This is black-faced Mother Kali of the Hindu system. The woman in her willfulness is symbolized here, with no enlightenment whatever. And this is an aspect in any human being. Every human being is male or female, and on the female side is polarized into this black aspect, which is sheer willfulness, non-rational, not desiring to know any illuminating truths, pursuing a willful course in the dark, a dark induced by its own willfulness. A darkness that would vanish if the willfulness stopped driving and sat down a moment and allowed itself to lapse back into the principle of the absolute which precipitated it. But the Yachin, the J-A-C-H-I-N, symbolizes very peculiar things. To establish, Yah, to affirm, Keen, the secret, continuously. So this white column, which you would expect to be the one that says to you, look, I'm on the up and up, I'm open, I'm clear, I'm spotless, and I'm not like that wicked dark column on the other side, who is entirely willful. This white column is saying, keep the secret. Now there is a very mysterious secret in polarity. What is the secret that women keep? Because this is a female card. Her left hand is full of kept secret, and her right hand is full of dark will. Try sometime, fellas, to abstract from any woman you know. You've already seen the dark will. Try to abstract from her that secret. I'll give it away. The white symbolizes her purity. White symbolizes that no matter what a woman does, it doesn't matter what it is, she remains pure. In it, during it, and after it. And it, to her, it is as if she hadn't or is not doing it. Because she has this marvelous capacity for returning into the primal light, which prior to encapsulation is the only reality. And she can just fall out of her activities into this innocence, into this innocuous, illustrated pre-state of the absolute. So her secret is, which she keeps very well, is that if she swears eternal fidelity to you, she might be writing a letter to you instead of Y of you at that moment. She might be swearing, I'm swearing eternal fidelity to you equals primary urge. In which case you, Y-O-U, will do for now, even perhaps for here and now. But she remains faithful to her own purity, to her own unspottedness, to her own uncommittedness, so that all committals that she makes are committals provisionally in time because of her eternal committal to the supreme white. What is white? Shining, being, that supreme Jyotirlingam. To this he is faithful. To this perfect drive initiative, to this he is eternally faithful, but in time she is provisional. And she is testing everything in time to see if it should be what she knows it can't be, if it is in time. Namely this non-temporal, eternal, pure light power. The Pharos. Now she has the moon below her foot. If you read in the Revelation, you'll find that this woman, described in the Revelation, has the moon under her feet. The moon means phasic behavior. And remember, this selling creature, this high priestess, as opposed to low priestesses that you meet more often, the high priestess is able to subdue her phasicity, actually to control herself. This is the most astonishing thing. She can control her own cyclic behavior. This was evidenced during the war when women whose husbands were away fighting ceased to menstruate until the husbands came back. Now, not all of them did this, but some of them did it, and in sufficient numbers to make it worthwhile collecting statistics. And it showed that they have this peculiar capacity to put the moon under their feet, that is, to control their phasicity when they decide to. But women in time identified with various erroneous ideas tend to lose this. But this symbol tells you it is well within the possibility for a woman who knows her own substance and who is not ruined or covered by erroneous ideas actually to control her own ovulation at will. But this is fairly rare, luckily. You see that she has a white cross on her bosom, and this white cross again, purity, the vertical initiative, the horizontal inertia, and it is white, it is pure, it is unspotted, and it means that this polarity exists in woman. She has absolute potential of initiative, absolute potential of passivity in her. And she can switch either on or off immediately. So she's altogether a tremendously mysterious figure for an empirical materialistic rationalist to deal with. Let's remember she's merely the letter B, which means being in its cosmic sense. And we'll then go on to the next card. Now, here we see the Empress. And peculiarly, she has the symbol of Venus on her heart-shaped shield, and she's holding in her right hand a phallomorph, a symbol of a male, and on top of this symbol, she's holding an ovum, an egg, and she's saying, by this I dominate. Now, she is not the preceding lady, the high priestess. She is the ruler in the temporal process. And what we know from anthropological researches is that in the old days, when matriarchs ruled, they ruled by the strange fact that they could bring forth from themselves children, and that for a long time men did not know they had anything to do with it, and they attributed this power entirely to the woman. So to them, the woman was the supreme ruler in her own right, because she could make an egg inside herself, and she could nourish this egg, and she could bring forth a child, another egg maker, or a boy child. And therefore she symbolizes the most tremendous tyranny that is possible to have, the tyranny of the matriarch empress, who in the ancient world behaved so badly by her utter arbitrariness that she caused, finally, a revolt of her own sons, husbands, grandsons, and herself, by her arbitrariness, provoked the rise of the patriarchies to balance this arbitrary dominion. The reason she did it was because she only liked to feed the men she liked and not the men she didn't like. So if men went out hunting together, and they caught some deer and brought them back to the tribe, these had to be referred to the matriarch for distribution, and she would say, well, that fellow can have a nice shoulder, and he can have 2 inches of tail, but I don't like him. That was the sound that came out of the man when he was told 2 inches of tail. Now, this kind of arbitrariness produced over generations profound resentment in the men until finally they arose and overthrew her. But when we look at the symbology here, you will find corn below, coming up, and this symbolizes the agricultural cycle of the earth. And Mother Earth is tremendously important in this symbology. You remember the story of the three boys, two of whom were brothers, and they were told the one who was first to kiss his mother will rule the state. And the two brothers ran off home as fast as they could to kiss their mother, and the one who remained knelt down and kissed the earth. He ruled the state. He knew there was something more basic than a woman digging her finger in the ground and putting her favorite Egyptian lentil in it to grow another next year. The earth itself, its fertility and so on, its tremendous potential riches, is more of a mother than any temporal, finite individual female. That is what that boy knew from his father's initiation. But the corn symbolizes this agricultural cycle of the year, spring, summer, autumn, winter. There is a time of sowing, a time of growth, a time of reaping, and a time of enjoying. And the repetition of this cycle was identical. And so there is implicit in the matriarchy subordination to all repetitive cycles. This is tremendously important. In the female, it's a tendency to repeat the cycle of events. This is most obvious in the sexual situation. It's most obvious in having children. It's most obvious in the tendency for them to prefer substantial security to free initiative. Sometimes you see pomegranates on the garments of this lady, and they symbolize, because of their fullness of seeds, her own tremendous fertility. Because any woman, I quote Methuselah here, any woman is a natural enemy to any other woman for this reason. Any woman believes that she could fill the universe with her own progeny. She can have children, they can have children, they can have children. And within no time we have 20,000 million people on Earth, all born out of the same woman. This is an amazing fact that is basic and has to do with the mysterious symbol Yachin on the other one. She knows this is true. If she were given the opportunity, she could dominate infinite space with her progeny. Any woman knows this, and therefore any woman, you may say, oh well, I'm different, I'm cured, I've seen through it, but any woman basically, absolutely basically, is a natural enemy to any other woman. So that any other form of behavior other than explicit enmity is a sort of compromise with reality. If there is a masculine principle in the female, as well as a female principle, then this may actually produce in women existentially the stirrings of conscience if they do naughty tricks, like popular song, God helps the sister who comes between me and my man. If we remember this fundamental, we can be saved a lot of trouble, because the female aspect of your being corresponds to the substantial aspect. And it means that your substantial aspect really believes that it is the enemy of all other substantial aspects of other beings. And that means that as material beings, you are at war. Every being with a physical body thinks in terms of feeding itself, not other bodies. When we come to study the cycle of the year correctly, we'll see exactly what this signifies. But every being who is identified with his physical body or her physical body, because of that identification, is at war with every other body, because he wants feeding, he wants clothing, she wants refrigerator, etc. He wants, she wants, as an identified material being. And therefore the same law that governs this principle of empress, matriarch, materialist, mother principle, is just as strong in any man who is identified with his physical body as it is in a woman who is defending her physical progeny. A woman will fight like a tigress to defend her baby. And a man, when he's identified with his materiality, will fight like a fiend to protect his, what do they call it, percentage on his shares. Materialism is materialism, or materialism is materialism. The very fact that you have a material body means that if you identify, you will function like a woman and not like a purely logical being. And that is not a statement that you will function evilly. To the contrary, you will function for your private life quite efficiently up to a certain point. Because there is meaning in having a physical body, because it is a permanent reference point whilst you are in the time process, and the necessity of your evolution. The fact, of course, that she's got the sign of Venus on her escutcheon, and this heart shape speaks for itself to you. She plays the heart game. She doesn't think she can beat you with her fist, at least not usually. And she plays the sign of Venus, that is, a circle over the cross. And the circle means female, and the cross means male. This means she's playing the dominion of woman over man. And in an ordinary man, a male, his material being, that is his feminine nature, will try to dominate his logic. It will need things, it will want things. And because of this, it will overthrow his own logic inside him, as surely as an external woman will try to wheedle him into an irrational activity. Can we have the next one, please, David? Now, the emperor comes next. Now, this shows you another historical fact, that after the matriarchs had overplayed their hand, they produced a terrific revolt, and the men gathered together, and the Greeks fought the Amazons, and the Sabine ladies were raped because of their naughtiness, and the men rose to authority. And the historians will tell you about that, that at one stroke, woman was reduced by this revolt from the status of goddess, empress, to household chattel or goods. She became a slave with one blow, because the energy with which he had worshipped her, when he found out her trickery, was the same energy that he used to ill-treat her. So here he is on the throne, and you observe he has ram's heads on the corners of his throne, and this Ram, which is a Hindu mantra for fire energy, and this ram that you call the battering ram that knocks down the opposition, that bangs holes in the city walls. And Ram is Hebrew for high, the mighty, the powerful, he who rules the substance. This man, this revolting man, having revolted against the matriarchs, returns to the primary energy that she has been veiling from him. She has been saying, I am the veil in front of the temple for a long time. And now he says, I have penetrated the veil and I know the truth, Ram. In the zodiac, Ram is the cardinal fire sign. It means absolute energy. And he's saying to this matriarch that he has overthrown, I know what you did. You veiled for me that you are fundamentally energy, appetizable, and you pretended you were not, but I have discovered you. Therefore, I will be appetizable energy, but I will do something that you didn't do. I will apply it with formal efficiency and not by repetitive, cyclic, annual inertias. Of course, he's armed, and of course, he's cloaked. And you notice that his right knee is cloaked, the red cloak there on his right knee symbolizes energy. It is covering his right knee. And the right means your will, which is manifest. But it is covered over, it is hidden. His will is hidden. But his left knee he has exposed. That is, his reason. That means he will give you a reason for everything he does. If you like reasons, you can have one. You can have a handful if you like them.
because he knows how to invent reasons. Because he had been so badly treated by the matriarchs beforehand that he has grown out of his frustrations, out of his resentments, into a rational being. His rationality is nothing but his embodied frustration. The FR in frustration, and in fire, and the PR in PYR, in fire, in reason, in pi ratio, is the same. He will give you as many reasons as you like. And at knee level, that is, we will agree. We will have an agreement. You live in your castle, I live in mine. You promise not to attack me, I won't attack you. You've got your spies out, I've got my spies out. You're in bed with my maid, I'm in bed with your wife. Now, this is called fair game at the aristocratic level. There's no mystery here, other than the mystery for people who don't know. Therefore, his favorite slogan is, there are no mysteries to those who know. As for the rest, it is all mystery. But he is self-crowned. He's put himself a crown on of gold, and that means will. He has crowned himself. K-R-O-W-N. Kra is the base to create, and they own. You know about ownership. You create ownership. You say, that is mine. And you write your name on it. You put a flag on it. And you tell the man, you say, you see that? It's got my name on it. It's mine. I will pay you threepence a fortnight to guard it for me. Here's a large club. The man is so astonished, he takes the job. Now, after a time, people think, this is yours. And that is crownship. Anybody who can define in that way is entitled to wear a crown. In fact, he's got a crown up here, which he wears whether he likes it or not, knows it or not. So here is this man, and he is carrying a cross, and he knows the handle has become very, very long. It's the Venus cross again. This is a very great gift. The circle is still over the cross, and the cross means maleness, and the circle means femaleness. But mysteriously, the circle is smaller, and the cross is longer. Why hasn't he put the cross, which is below, above? The answer, he's no fool. If he put the cross above, everybody would know that he was saying, I am superior to women. And that no gentleman would ever say. Look up the etymology of gentleman and you'll find out why. May we have the next card, please, David? And we now come to the high priest. And he is the brother of the emperor. And these two have connived together. He is a hierophant. This phant part, like in elephant, Phanein, to appear, as in epiphany. He is the one who will give you the appearance of a hierarchy of powers. Hieros is his priest. Hierarchy. And I will give you the appearance of hierarchy. What is the appearance of hierarchy? A very large building with spires or domes according to period. It's certainly very big, so that when you go inside a well-built cathedral, the first thing you feel standing in the nave is like a nave. The whole game is to make you feel your minitude in the presence of this colossal structure. Even if you go into that Wren building in London, it actually impresses you by its sheer size. This is the appearance of hierarchy. For the appearance of hierarchy, you need magnitude to impose relatively minitude on the observer. So he connives with his dear brother, the emperor, to make the appearance of power bigger and bigger and bigger. So if you go into ancient Egypt or Babylon or India, you find absolutely fantastic things, which are called temples of the Most High God. In a flat land like Egypt, they just dragged stones from anywhere they could find them and made their mountains. But in India, where they had lots of nice mountains, quite simply they took a mountain and they carved into the mountain and left bits of it standing up, and they look like columns. And there are gods and magnificent scenes from mythology, all carved out of a single mountain. Vaishnavas is tremendously impressive. No human being can go there without being impressed by the magnitude of the undertaking, and it makes him feel like a mini being. So here we see two gentlemen before him who have had their hair removed from their head by a special dispensation under Vesa, to remind them that Samson, when he lost his hair, was weak. That to cut off this part of the hair means, I'm not boasting. If you examine, say, the ancients, they often used to tie their hair in a tuft. You've seen that in the samurai. And they say, well, if Cox can do this, why can't I do it? So I'll draw my hair up a stick and decorate it. And this they did to symbolize power. Obviously, if you've got a 3-foot hairdo, you're taller than if you've only got a 1-inch hairdo. And sheer magnitude is quite something. Some devil mouse make pygmy men a respectable size. And they're much more frightening with a 3-foot false head on than they would be at their own height. So these men are genuflecting before this great authority. And this authority has round his neck a rather disguised rope. This white thing that goes round his neck and hangs down really derives from a rope. And what he's saying is, we are all pendant absolutely on the absolute. And we must remember that, fellas. And remember I said it first. If I say it first, then you must bend the knee to me because you didn't say it. I said it first, you bend your knee. If you had said it first, I would bend my knee to you. But I said it first. And now I'm going to teach you a lovely little trick. Remember, you are all pendant absolutely on the absolute, and pass the word round. So although I said it first, if you say it second, the third will be indebted to you, the fourth to the third, the fifth to the fourth, and so on. So the indebtedness will go right down the line till the caterpillars get it. Again, we see the rose and the lily. There are two aspects of being a good representative of any major religion. One is develop, that is, do your reading. You must know your text, use your intellect. And the other is a little bit of sport. If you want to know exactly how sporty it is possible for a divine to be, read the poems of Robert Herrick. They're very charming, aren't they, dear? Now, he's carrying a cross, which is crossed 3 times. And you know that a double cross is called a paternity cross in heraldry, and he's got a triple cross. Now, one cross is enough, surely, but 2 is 1 too many, and 3 is 2 too many. And for him. But he's not holding it for him. He's holding it for you. In the days when one cross was popular, how are you going to practice one-upmanship except without another horizontal? You must reduce your opponent, either knock his horizontal off so he's just got a straight sticker upper, like a common plant growing out of the earth, or you must add another one to your own, and then another. Why not? Why not 7? Until it becomes unwieldy. But every bar that you get like this, it's like stripes on a soldier's arm, you know. They're very impressive. If you see a large army of people with no stripes, and suddenly you see one with the stripe, and the one with the stripe has a nose slightly up, the mind unconsciously associates the up nose with the stripe. And if when he has 2 stripes, the nose goes higher, and 3 higher still, maybe you'll get it. I mean, how many stripes will he get? And then crowns and wings and all kinds of things. And these are absolutely astonishing in their influence. Because they mean something, they must do. I mean, obviously, if you're wearing them, they mean something. And if they mean something, and you don't know what it means, you had better be careful. That's very, very important. Therefore, he carries a cross of crosses and says, well, you see, really, there are 3 worlds. There's the fact that we are crucified intellectually on ideas, the fact that we are crucified emotionally on our like-dislike, from the fact that we are crucified on our ancestral impulses. We have ancestors, and the ancestors have left in our protoplasm records of all the things they did that they liked doing. Sometimes they liked courting ladies, other times they liked removing heads. But you are full of impulses from your ancestors, some to destroy and some to make love. But they're there, and they're the lowest bar on that triple cross. Now he has hanging from his beautiful hat, which originally was a fish head, two nice ribbons, and they symbolize that whatever he says must be taken in a sense other than he says it, to get it right. It is the symbol of double talk. You also find in the courts gentlemen who wear a special little tie that divides itself. And it means whatever I say, I must warn you before I say it, that it can be taken in more ways than one. It's rather like one says at the beginning of a certain festival, when you say, anything I may say in the coming year is hereby, out of the honesty of my heart, beforehand rendered null and void. Don't say I didn't warn you. And this is what the tales coming down. They mean dialectic, they mean polarity, they mean the double intention in everything. Kierkegaard's hermit has this very, very clearly in his mind, that he thinks you ought to do it only to ladies. That when you speak to women, you must always mean something to yourself other than you're saying to her. Because if you don't, you're not a proper hermit. This is tremendously important to understand. And there are goals, that is, they're willful. That is, he is in no sense bound by the reasons that emerge from his head in this polarized manner. And he has built a hierarchy, and magnitude is going to impress and impose minitude on all the observers right down the scale. Please, David. Now, here's a card, the lovers, and it symbolizes man and woman on earth after the emperor has overthrown the empress and the Hierophant has connived with the emperor to make a social structure's rules, an ethic. And the first thing they are saying, and quite correctly, is man and woman are blessed by powers from above, angelic forces, by divine forces. And the sun is the source of that energy, and the sun's being is feminine, and the sun's radiation is masculine. And so the radiation force comes down in Adam, and the being force comes down in Eve. Eve means developmental energy. In the background is a mountain. This mountain has many significances, but fundamentally it means a pushing up from the earth, the possibility of a potential rise to build above the flatness of the earth's repetitive cycle, to make a prominence which will be a landmark and a finger pointing into the heavenly power from which it derived. And the runes are saying, angelically, I bless this relationship. This is all major religions saying sex is sacred, sex is holy, marriage is sacred, marriage is holy. And remember what we said about the beginning of wisdom in the beginning, and again the lily signifies the necessity of persuading human beings to relate to human beings and not to other beings is indicated in this card. The lovers must believe that their relationship is sacred and holy and absolutely divinely justified and angelically guarded. The angel there means messenger forces from solar energy coming down into the male and female to bring them into relation. The same force that comes from the sun as radiation appears in man as intellection. The sun's being, and that includes the whole solar field, appears in woman as her very being. Therefore, in the revelation, she is said to be clothed with the sun. Just as she has the moon, transient behavior, under her foot, so she is clothed with the sun. And the sun's metal is gold, and that symbolizes will. And therefore, she is a being of pure will. She's a will being, will to be. But the man is radiating. The man is giving out. The man is investigating with his shafts, his spears of light, equals intelligence, investigating the infinite. So the Hierophant, the high priest, has formulated an ethic, a rule of sexual relations and marital relations, in order to help the emperor to establish a state on earth. There must be stability of relation, and humans must belong to humans, and higher humans to higher humans. So there's a hierarchy within the human race. There you see the origin of the aristocratic concept, that the best people ought to marry the best people and not the worst people.
Why is she on the right?
She's on the right because the right means will and the left means intellection. A man is there put on the sinister side because he's thinking. That's why he gets into trouble. She's on the right side, and as you can see, she's turning out her left hand, saying nothing hidden in it, and left means to deceive. So she's saying, look, I'm perfectly honest, but the right hand is doing something quite different. The will, remember, is not committed to form. You can use it, but it's not committed to it. Now we come to this chariot, and here we see a man symbolizing a very peculiar thing. You know, in this,
is that supposed to do that, isn't it?
You know that in the Bible you have a prodigal son, and the prodigal son asks his father to give him his inheritance, and then he leaves home and he goes about adventuring, and eventually he gets right down to living with pigs and eating husks. Now pigs symbolize obstinacy, and husks the most superficial externals that there are possible to have. So the end state of that fellow is to be at the bottom, to be in pure obstinacy, and the most superficial it is possible for a human being to become. But there is another aspect to it. It's of tremendous importance. In the Bible, after the murder of Abel, a new son was given in his place, called Seth. And out of this son, there emerged a line which were later called the sons of God, whereas the lineal descendants of Cain, who was a murderer, are called sons of men. So you have sons of the principle of unity and sons of the principle of plurality. So this chariot here symbolizes the illegitimate son of aristocracy, either military or ecclesiastical, either the warrior caste in India or the priest caste. And he's driving along, and you notice he has on his chariot here a little golden disc symbolizing the sun, and it has wings, meaning thought, blue wings. That means you don't only have a will, but you also have thought. And this thought has come out of frustration, because as a bastard son of a good father with a great empire, naturally you think you're entitled to the empire when the father dies. And therefore, bastard sons need watching when kings die, because normally they will try to secure the throne. But this particular chariot here has on his escutcheon a top spinning. That means a disc with a peg through it. Now the symbology of this is tremendously important, because the lily and the rose are in the top. The vertical is the rose, and the round disc is the lily. And he must keep this top spinning for balance. That means he must never forget in himself that his equilibrium depends on his initiative and his will and his physical body inertias, the spinning disc, the feminine nature.